Hello there, and welcome to another episode of Marketing Room 101, the podcast where I invite marketers for a good old rant and give them the chance to banish one thing from the industry forever. I'm Ben Norman, your host and self-appointed guardian of Marketing Room 101. In my day job, I head up strategy at Principles, a brand comms agency in Leeds. And I started this podcast because I both deeply love and occasionally loathe the marketing world. So I wanted to provide a safe space for those who feel the same to vent and banish their nemesis forever. In this episode, I chat to Christina Garnett, who can now add first ever international visitor of Marketing Room 101 to her incredible CV. Christina is a fractional chief customer officer and founder of Pocket CCO, and she helps businesses to understand their customers better, to make them happier, and to retain them longer, which she's done for Fortune 500 companies through to startups and small businesses. Her knowledge in social listening, customer experience, and community building is featured in courses by the likes of HubSpot Academy, SEMrush, and Heyorka, and she's featured in Adweek, Forbes, Entrepreneur, and many, many more. So in short, she's the real deal. What really struck me about this conversation was just how much useful stuff Christina was able to just reel off. I came out of this chat with tons of notes on things that I can do straight away to help make customers happier, and hopefully you'll feel the same. So here's my conversation with Christina Garnett. Christina, welcome to Marketing Room 101.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to chat.
How does it make you feel to be the first ever international guest in here?
I'm honored. Thank you so much for asking me. I appreciate it.
So just to help our listeners, if you could set the scene, what is it like in here in Marketing Room 101?
It's very opinionated and territorial. So there's a lot of people vying to be the winner of the marketing idea. Everyone's kind of fighting for who gets credit instead of being collaborative.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds quite toxic. I won't put you on the spot and ask you if that's evocative of anywhere that you've been previously, but it sounds like somebody who might have some experience there.
A little bit, yes.
So having done a little bit of research, I found something really interesting where you described the beauty of being a nosy child. And I thought there's something in that that was really interesting. Tell me how being a nosy child became your superpower in what you do.
Yeah. So growing up, I could never learn enough. I was always curious. I wanted to know what people were talking about, what people were thinking about, what people were concerned about, what was going on. I was constantly reading the room before I realized reading the room was a thing. And so it really became my superpower in the sense that I'm constantly doing audience intelligence. I do social listening. I look at customer feedback. I'm always consciously and unconsciously trying to figure out what people are thinking and saying and what are they thinking versus what they're saying. So I think it's been a really cool thread throughout my career and something that's continued to drive me because I'll never know it all. So I might as well just keep going.
There's almost something liberating about knowing that the answer always changes depending on the context.
Yeah.
So, you know, as long as you know to listen and to be nosy, you can always find an answer.
Yep, absolutely. And I don't think it's a coincidence that when people, whether it be like CEOs or founders or anybody that's being asked about like what skill or what specific attribute do they want to see in people when they're hiring, and almost always it's intellectual curiosity. And I think that leads and fuels so many other skill sets, whether you're going to be a problem solver or whether you are resilient or not, or whether you are closed-minded or not. A curious person is never going to be closed-minded because even if they disagree with somebody, they want to know why that person doesn't see things from the same lens. And so I think it constantly pushes you forward because you know there's never going to be this like all-knowing moment.
I think there's something really interesting what you're saying about the power of not seeing something from somebody else's point of view, but understanding why somebody sees it from their point of view. I think it's quite a powerful distinction.
I think so too. I think it's really helpful to know that context and nuance are real. And so even if you drastically disagree with somebody, understanding what is the nudge or the provocation for the behavior, because in a lot of cases, they may not even be able to articulate why they did something. But if you're able to go deep enough, you're able to find the trigger for that behavior. And so I'm obsessed with game theory. I'm obsessed with behavioral psychology. I'm very excited about the idea of being able to discover more and more and more. And I think that that also comes with a modicum of respect, because the fact that you want to take the time to understand why someone feels differently than you, I think is a really powerful thing.
So now we understand the nosy child and now the nosy adult a little bit more. I was really interested in asking, what do you believe the role of AI may be for a person obsessed with human insight and human behavior?
I think it's really important to note that we can't put the genie back in the bottle. So whether you are a huge avid believer in AI and you want it to touch everything, or you are a hater and absolutely don't want it to have anything to do with your work. I think it is necessary to understand that it is going to be incorporated into our work and in a lot of our everyday lives as marketers. It's already happening. So it's not a matter of how can we stop it. It's how can we have it be as impactful in a positive way as humanly possible. And so for me, I find it as a great opportunity to be able to look at data in ways that you yourself may not be able to look at on a more granular level, to be able to ask it questions, to be able to drive efficiency in your thought process. Because a lot of companies, they say that they want to learn more about their customers, but then they never act on it. And so for the ones who can't because of budget or because of time, an AI is a huge opportunity for them to put their foot in the water, put their toe in, and really start analyzing the data to be able to decide, all right, here's all the data that we've collected. What does this even say? And what does this mean? So that the person who does care, the human, can then say, based on these findings, here are the actions that we need to be thinking about. Here are the questions that we need to continue asking. And so I think it needs to drive efficiency. But I do think it's important to note that there are brands that are, Coca-Cola is a great example. So their Christmas ad clearly used AI in it. And there's no hiding that. They were very clear about it. And it's had a lot of negative impact. And I think that there's multiple ways where that negativity is coming from. You have the obvious nature of creatives that are being locked out, that you're instead using AI to replace humans. So that's obviously problematic. I think another thing to note is that the Christmas element is a very emotional, nostalgic, powerful, emotional resonant campaign. So you're using something that can't emote to create emotion from somebody else. And it does not work. Will it work in the future? Maybe. I obviously don't know. But to assume that you can create emotional resonance from something that does not have emotion itself, I don't think that that's a hard argument to make. And so I think that we need to have a line drawn as to where humanity will drive empathy and where AI will drive efficiency. And I think together, if you're very clear about what needs to stay human and what can be done in a more efficient manner and have those two worlds work together, that is going to be the mix that we need to create in order for AI to be integrated in a way that is not combative, that is not territorial, but is instead cooperative and collaborative with creatives instead of against them.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating point of view, because it's very easy to imagine AI taking over everything. It's very easy to take this simplistic view of what AI will do, which is AI will replace the whole creative industry. AI will replace the whole marketing industry. It won't, will it? But it's the same. It's not just in our industry. It's in agriculture. It's in healthcare. It's in so many different areas. And I think the way that you've just described it there is AI helping us to connect with humans, helping us to understand humans. The word human is always in there. It's not a case of AI replacing that, is it?
Yes. I think it's important to have that distinction, because I think that a lot of creatives are fearful in how AI is creating more and more encroachment into their jobs. And they can see that the work is not good enough, that it's not the same. But if that's not why they were replaced, then it doesn't matter. If they were replaced to cut budget, then it not being good enough is relevant, unless they lose market share and revenue. The consequences have to outweigh whatever their motivations were to replace with AI in the first place. And so I think there needs to be this understanding that there is this opportunity for creatives to be able to do more because of AI, not less.
So if we consider both what you've just talked about around AI and also the superpower of being a more nosy person, if we were to consider some of our listeners right now being perhaps not in a position to recruit a chief customer officer, what's one thing that you suggest they could do right now without spending any money to start to better understand their customers?
I would create a customer journey map. Really dive into what the customer journey looks like and what it looks like post sale. Because usually when people think about the customer journey, they think about, okay, so now there's awareness and then consideration. They think about that, but they don't think about what happens after they become a customer. How do you make them feel special if they return, if they convert again? Do you have things in place to encourage them to be an advocate for you? Do you have a customer community? Whatever that looks like. Build out what the customer looks like in all of those pieces. And then I want you to add one more piece to it, which is an empathy map. And that's when you're going to be thinking about getting into the headspace of the customer at each of those phases of the customer journey and thinking, what are they thinking at this moment? What are they saying? What are they feeling? What are they seeing? What are they hearing? Are they hearing jingles during holiday season from a competitor? Yeah. Are they seeing a big out-of-home ad on the way home from work? Are they getting retargeting ads? You have to really think about all of these variables and the empathy map on top of that customer journey. The only thing it costs you is time for you to get into the headspace of your customer. You are competing against variables you don't even know exist, but because they take the attention or the money or the emotional weight from your customer, all of those things impact your business. But if you don't have an empathy map, then you're just always going to see it as it's us versus them, but you're going to miss the real reason they didn't go with you.
I think there's something really fascinating about considering alternatives rather than competitors. The number one competitor to purchasing your product at any given moment is often not purchasing anything.
Yeah.
The way that you've just talked about plotting that funnel is similar to Mark Ritson talks about the way that he builds a funnel. There is no generic funnel, no one size fits all. Like you say, what is your journey from awareness to conversion? But then also people can buy you in different ways. They may never buy you again. They may never recommend. So let's stop considering it. It just gets to this point at the bottom.
And that goes back to being curious. You're never going to know it all because you could have the most beautifully well-crafted customer journey and then the economy slips. And the person who was thinking one thing last year is in a whole different headspace tomorrow.
You talk about knowing the customer well enough. And I thought the idea of mapping the funnel with an empathetic understanding of the audience, something that I've not seen done in that specific way before. And I think that's really interesting. How would you suggest that that business, what can they do to start to understand that customer better if perhaps they don't have that data sat there or they're not aware of how to use it? What sort of things would you suggest that they could start to do to gain that better understanding?
Get as close to your customer as possible. Like, do a current audit of what you do. Do you do feedback surveys? If so, how often? Where does that data go? If so, who gets to see that data once it's compiled? Is there a post-mortem for surveys? So I'd look at that first. Do you do a CSAT or do an NPS? Do you have a Google My Business or Yelp or TrustRadius? Like, do you do review sites? If so, how often are you monitoring those? Are you checking for patterns? Are you responding to positive and negative? Do you respond to positive and negative feedback the same way that you do neutral? Those are the people who actually have the most opportunity for you because they're not low enough and so angry that they're going to cancel immediately or as soon as they can, but they're not happy. So that's an opportunity for you to reach out to them to say like, hey, we saw that you gave us like a 6 out of 10, wanted to learn more about your experience and see what we could do to make that a little bit better for you. If you have time to chat in a world of AI, I'm letting you talk to a human. In the world of AI, I'm not going to pass you off to a bot that's going to drive efficiency. I'm giving you the most valuable resource I have. I'm going to give you time. And for people who are trying to decide between you and a very similar competitor, they're going to remember the one that made them feel heard and seen and approached.
You're here today because you would like to banish something from the world of marketing forever. Can I ask what you would like to banish, please?
Silos. I hate them. I absolutely hate them. If I could take an axe to all of them, I would.
And in what sense do you hate silos? And what sort of silos do you hate? So talk me through your hatred for silos.
Yeah, so I find that I really like working with startups and agencies because they are small enough that there is really no need for individual departments and all of these things. So you're able to come from a really agile place of the work has to get done and it has to get done well. As companies scale and grow, then because of that size, they now have to have departments. And now we have to have even more of a structured infrastructure of like layers and responsibilities. But in the business of driving that organization, what you're doing is you're creating structures that will then be pit against each other. Because now this department wants to go up against this department for credit, or this department needs to have final say so before this department is able to move forward. And so what you have is you wind up stepping on top of each other. You wind up having structures in place that make it harder to collaborate and you lose agility. I find that if you look at the best marketing teams and you look at the best marketing work, you see deep collaboration, you see agility, and the idea that they just want the company to win. I don't care who gets their name beside this little thing right here. I want the company to win. And I think that that really kind of showcases an underlying understanding of it's about the work and not who gets credit for it. And so I think Cannes is a great example of this. I know a ton of people who work for agencies and in-house for brands, and they do incredible work. They'll be up for a Lion, they'll be up for a Webby, they'll be up for all these things. But then they're not the ones that ever get to go to be the one to get it. I've had friends who've had to basically like debrief what the entire project was to the person who's going to actually accept the award for no other reason than they had the right title. And that title had to be the one to accept it. And that is the opposite of collaboration. And so I'm the one that loves the people who won Cannes and they get a Lion, but they like take all of the time humanly possible. And it's like, all right, let's look at the credits. And it almost looks like a movie end credits. Those are the people I love because they're saying like, I know only one of us can come on the at the podium, but you're all here. All of your names are on this. We all did this together. Like that's the mark of great marketing and collaboration. And I think that once you see it, you can't unsee it. And that's the bar for me is, how can we work together to get this across the finish line and get it across the finish line in a way where it is the pinnacle of good work? And it has nothing to do with, well, brand did this and ad did that and like social did this piece. The idea that you're going to come together and you're going to work together for this singular campaign that can exist in different ways across all of these departments, that takes a lot of energy and it takes a lot of humility and a lack of ego. And it takes people who either have made sure those silos don't get structured or they've broken through those silos to say, we're only going to do really great work if we work together.
Yeah, no, I think you make a really strong case there. And I think there's something about the tension between individual greatness and greatness within a team. Because I think arguably individual moments of greatness exist more when there is a great team allowing that to happen. So it's not like actually if there is a moment of individual greatness, a really great creative idea, a Cannes Lion winning piece of work, that might be down to somebody's individual creative greatness at one point. But that's a very, very, very specific point in a very long journey often, isn't it? It's about the team that have provided that space, the amount of time that they need to work on that piece of work. It's about the confidence of the team behind them to help to sell that piece of whatever it might be. But yeah, I think it's interesting thinking, we're not saying that we don't respect and appreciate and value those moments of individual greatness. We're just saying that they never happen without all these people behind them.
100%. And I think it's also interesting too. I'm seeing this more in the social media space, but I know that the ad world sees it too, where there's this concept of show horses versus workhorses. And so there's so many workhorses that have kind of just, they know they do really good work, but they know that they're not being seen because they don't have a certain number of followers or they aren't going on podcasts. And so what you're seeing is a lot of these people stepping up to be thought leaders or influencers, even if they don't want to, because they know they can be a workhorse. They know it. But in order to get to the next level, they have to become a show horse. They have to care about their personal brand. They have to care about how polished they look or what they talk about or where they show up. Are they being quoted in this certain article? And so I think that that is a symptom. This whole push for everyone trying to be a thought leader, I think is deeply tied into that, is there's a lot of really brilliant workhorses who've seen people who are show horses but didn't necessarily do the work be in that position because they've done the personal brand thing. And so now more of the workhorses are going up and being like, all right, well, I've seen how people do it. I just got to go through the motions and do it myself. And so I'm glad that they're getting their kudos finally. I wish that like the workhorses could get as much love as the show horses.
Yeah, because the workhorses are the best for the team, right? They're the ones that are staying the latest. They're the ones that are grafting all the time. And if we start to unpick that, or we start to flip that narrative away from celebrating the workhorses behind the scenes, then what does that mean? Does it mean everybody's always competing to be the show horse? Does it mean that that starts to create tension within teams? Does that start to create silos as you talk about? I'm interested in knowing. So when you talk about working with smaller businesses, you talk about working with agencies, and within those perhaps smaller businesses, there's a chance to be more collaborative. But what happens when you do convert that to a business at scale? Or how would you present an alternative way of working to a business at scale that prevents the issue of silos?
I think having a culture that is focused on positive reinforcement and where there's not this zero-sum game, where it isn't just one person does this. in startups and honestly in companies of all sources, you see the whole focus on attribution. And there's even arguments of like attribution is a lie, or you're chasing all these metrics to figure out. But the whole point of attribution is we know, and if you look at your customer journey map, you'll realize that multiple people touch these customers.
Yeah.
So there are multiple people who can impact whether or not they have an okay experience, they have an amazing experience, or they hate it. There's so many touch points. So to believe that only one person should be hailed as like the customer hero is disingenuous. And I think I think if you come from a very customer-centric place, then I think it sets a culture of everyone on the team is empowered to do their best work to ensure that we are creating the best possible customer experience. And so if you see someone struggling, you have the power to be able to step up and say like, hey, I work for this company. I saw that you posted this negative thing on LinkedIn, or I saw that you posted this on TrustRadius or whatever, and be able to look at them and say, I am not assigned to you, but because I am assigned to this company as a whole, I want to help. And that removes the ego. You are making the company and the customer the center of the universe instead of my team, me, my person. Like it completely rephrases and restructures how you look at your work when you make the customer the center. If the gravitational pull is around the customer, then we should all be working towards making them better. And so as you're scaling, if you really want to be a customer-centric company, then as you scale, you need to be very protective of what values do not get stretched.
Yeah.
Because as you grow, you wind up making choices. We're going to choose this whatever over that value because it's harder when we're bigger to do what we used to do. That's a choice. And sometimes you don't realize you're making it, but if you make a core list of like, when I say we're customer centric, this is what that means to us.
Yeah.
It means that they're going to be at the center of our universe. What are the values that pertain to that, that we're not willing to sacrifice for the sake of scaling up and then holding true to that? Okay, well, that's what you want to protect. How are you going to protect it? Are there red flags that you might see along the way that show you that you're leaving your path?
Yeah, I think there's a real point coming through there around we align everybody around the customer, but then as we structure our reward for the team, as we structure our objectives, our KPIs, if we set them all at an individual team level, you'd literally create a silo around that, don't you? Whereas if you can set everybody on track for a single ambition, a single goal, a single objective, and that is the customer, then we are all accountable together for the same objectives, aren't we?
And that also helps businesses because there's also a lot of teams that they know what they need to measure. But when they sit in on like the annual kickoff meeting for the business and the business will talk about the umbrella goals and then they're looking at their KPIs and I'm like, I don't know why a YouTube view number has anything to do with that business net new revenue goal. So having the umbrella goals for the company and then being able to niche down to say, all right, well, what the work looks like for you, if you measure this and you get it right, then it's going to lead up to behaviors that actually work to impact in a positive way the overall umbrella metric.
Okay, I am going to take silos from you and they are now going to be banished from the marketing industry. They're going to stay here in Marketing Room 101. Yeah, how do you feel about that?
You can have them. They are yours. You're welcome.
Thank you. So while you're here, is there anything that you would like to bring back or anything you would like to return to the marketing industry? What would you like to return?
I'd like to return game theory. I'm a massive behavioral psychology person and I love game theory. And I find that a lot of marketers do the first 2 to 3 steps of game theory, whether they even know what they're doing. They just naturally start thinking about it, but they don't go as far as they could. And I think that that would lead to significantly stronger marketing. So I got to go with game theory.
So if we imagine ourselves, we are a marketing agency of some description, and we want to introduce game theory. What does that look like across the business at an operational level? And what are the first steps into doing that?
So the first thing I would do is I would let people know what it is. And so for layman's, I usually mention Doctor Strange. And so I'll mention like the Marvel movies. And there's a very specific moment where Doctor Strange, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, he's meditating. And you see him like looking through all of these different options of basically how are all the different ways that this plays out. And then when he's finished, he puts up one finger. And it's to denote to the Avengers, spoiler alert, that there's only one way out of all the probabilities that they will be able to defeat Thanos. And so that is game theory at its most visually sound. You have all these probabilities of all these different ways that you could behave, in this case, your customer. And you have to figure out, basically, out of all the paths, what's the ideal path for them to take? And so going back to that customer journey map, thinking about, so we have the customer journey map, we have the empathy on top of that. Now you're going to add one more layer, and that layer is going to be a nudge. Because a lot of times what we wind up seeing in the customer journey is we think about how to get them to the next place. All right, well, they know who we are. Now I got to get them to actually start thinking about us and maybe wanting a demo or maybe looking at pricing or something like that. That's fine. But you need to also look at the full journey. Not only how am I getting them here, but how am I getting them all the way through? Great way to think about this is sales. Let's say that you are on the path. You find this really cool product that you want to use or a really cool tool. So you're aware that it exists and you start considering it and then you talk to sales and then they lie to you. They tell you it does something better than it does, or they tell you it does something that it absolutely does not do. Yes, you got the sale, but there's nothing that anyone can do post-sale to fix and get you to nudge you correctly through the rest of the journey, because you've already destroyed trust with them because your salesperson lied. And so when I did work with advocacy, a lot of my job was basically like, hey, you love us? Here's how you can love us better in a more like specific targeted way that you feel special and I get measurable results. But if someone has a bad taste in their mouth, like they could love the product, but they don't trust us because of something we've said or done in the past, I can't do customer advocacy because I'm too busy doing triage on a relationship that I did not break. And so thinking about how you treat those people at each individual segment and then how you get them to the next segment is huge. So thinking about how are you going to nudge them to not only get through the awareness stage to consideration, but also to get them all the way through. And that could be as simple as having a culture at your company that says, this is how we talk to our customer, no matter where they are in the journey. We are always helpful. We are always kind. We are always open to questions. We apologize. Whatever that looks like. I don't care where you sit on a team. I don't care what you're responsible for. I don't care what your KPIs are. If you see someone that needs help, no matter where they are on the journey, you're going to step up and you're going to be kind and you're going to be welcoming and you're going to be patient. Things like that, that in itself is a nudge.
I find it fascinating the way that you described using game theory as a way of not just considering getting that person at all costs to the next stage in a journey, but considering the end game as being a retained, happy customer who loves you and will be going on recommending you to everyone. Because it's so easy, isn't it, to look at a funnel and looking at the empathy aspect of that and thinking, at all costs, I'm going to get this customer to that next stage, which can incentivize bad behavior, can't it? It can incentivize that salesperson to exaggerate. It can incentivize you to do things or say things that will lead to a conversion into the next stage, but then in sacrifice of every stage thereafter. If there's one thing I'd love it if anybody listening to this took away from this, I think it is that consideration of that whole lifetime value of a customer. If customers love you for a long time, then you're going to fare better commercially, aren't you, as a business?
Mm-hmm. You absolutely are. And I think it speaks to the funnel versus the journey too, because retention is not necessarily what you think it is. You're choosing to see the behavior in one way. So getting back to like what we talked about with the empathy mapping, you have customers who are retaining you that absolutely hate you, but you're the cheapest dog in town, or you don't have any competition. But as soon as someone was able to beat you on price or was able to create a feature that you do, they will leave you in a heartbeat. And it's because you saw the retention number as, well, see, they stayed. So we did good enough. But it's not good enough to stay. It's good enough until something else comes along. It's good enough until there is competition. It's good enough until the pricing changes. So they're not really sticky. So that's why you need to look at the quantitative data as well as the qualitative. I find that a lot of companies over-index on the number side, but they don't look at qualitative. So you could have someone that stays, but if you're not looking at their reviews and their feedback, then you may not realize that they absolutely hate your guts, but they're stuck with you. And then on top of that, you also have the idea that how are people choosing to come back? So for example, if the only thing you're doing when someone becomes a customer is you're setting up a 3-month calendar invite before their next contract renewal happens, that is not a relationship.
No.
But it is to so many companies. And it bothers me. I've had this happen to me where I was working with a vendor and I would ask questions or I would need help. And it's very difficult to get in touch with them. But 3 months before your renewal date is up, they are so easy to find and track down. They can't wait to make time for you. You've already made your choice. So you ignored them for 9 months and assumed that everything was fine because they didn't burn your company down. And then 3 months before renewal, you keep swinging back in to say like, hey, it's been real. How are you? And I'm like, I don't know. How are you? I've literally, you've been a stranger for 9 months. How would that make anybody feel?
I think that brings it back around to what you talked about right at the very start around applying the empathy map to the customer journey. And like you say, that's not just at what, how does somebody feel at the start, but it's how does somebody feel when they're actually receiving your services? How likely are they to stay with you? Because I think that's a really important thing to consider. People can buy your product and dislike you because of a lack of time to change, a lack of money to afford something different, all the reasons that you'd suggested earlier. So I think that's a really, really neat way of bringing this all back around. And I'm absolutely sold. So I will take the silos. I'll keep the silos and then let you take game theory and I'll let you introduce it into every business in the industry. I'm not sure if you'll be aware of this. I highly doubt it. This podcast does have one super fan. That super fan also happens to be my brother. And my brother, he doesn't work in the industry. And he has asked if he can ask a guest one question on each episode. So the question that he has asked me to ask you before you leave is, if you could put one thing about the UK into Room 101 and banish it forever, what would it be? You won't offend anybody in the UK, I promise you.
I'm thinking. There's so many things. I'm an Anglophile, so I love the UK. I'm actually going there in December. So there's a lot to love. It would probably be beans on toast. I don't understand.
Beans on toast.
It's not that I hate it. I just don't understand. It goes back to my curiosity. Like, make me understand beans on toast. Make me understand why that's a thing.
I would say beans on toast is kind of, it's a comfort thing. I had beans on toast when I was a kid. In particular, if I wasn't feeling very well, there's something about the lower quality the bread, the better often. So you have cheap white supermarket bread, cheap butter. You've got the kind of crispiness of the bread with the softness of the beans. I don't know, but there are a lot of people in the UK that don't like that as well, I think. Yeah. Have you tried beans on toast?
I have. It's not for me. But if it's a nostalgia play, that like that, I guess.
It's a better way of saying what I was meant to say. And I think it's kind of nostalgic comfort.
Yeah. Because like for us, when I was growing up, if we didn't feel well, it was saltine crackers, chicken soup, and ginger ale. Like ginger ale and crackers would like solve just about any problem you had. And that was the go-to. All you had to do was like cough very loud. And all of a sudden your parents would show up and there's like this massive box of saltine crackers and ginger ale. And you just knew that like, yep, we're going to get this all resolved.
That's not with the chicken soup as well. I mean, yours sounds much better than beans on toast. No wonder.
Oh, chicken soup. It's fantastic. It's all cozy and warm. Yeah.
So I think that feels like the perfect note to finish on. Christina, how can people get hold of you if they want to contact you? How do people find out more about what you do?
So my website is PocketCCO because a lot of people have wanted to work with me and said they wish I was in their pocket. So I'm a Pocket Chief Customer Officer. And then I'm that Christina G across all socials. And you can also find me on LinkedIn.
Brilliant. Okay. Christina, thank you very much for visiting.
Thanks for having me.
So that was my conversation in Marketing Room 101 with Christina Garnett. If you enjoyed it, could you please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts? It's apparently really important for helping more people to discover the show. And of course, that would mean more people trying to make the marketing world a better place. If you really enjoyed it, please share it with other people. And if you hated it, of course, just keep that to yourself. This podcast is not sponsored by Principles Agency. If it was, it'd probably be hosted by someone capable of saying less than 100 times in a single episode, which I've had to painstakingly edit out. But as it's where I work and they give me and everyone else a day off every week, which I spend doing things like this, I feel obliged to give it a plug. At Principles, we're obsessed with the word unforgettable, meaning we help everyday brands come to mind quicker and stay there longer. We do this using a set of principles the team and I developed. This means making brands distinctive, entertaining, visible, and consistent. If you'd like to chat about how we can help you or learn more about the principles of unforgettable brands, just pop me, Ben Norman, or Principles Agency a message on LinkedIn or head to principlesagency.co.uk.